Hello, this is Aaron Kupferberg for Power Popaholic, and today I am talking to the wonderful guitarist Tommy Keen, who has a new album out called Behind the Parade. How are you doing today, Tommy?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
Great, great. I can only think of a few people with your guitar talent and ability who started in the early 80s who's been really consistent and an amazing advocate of power pop. I would say contemporaries like Chris Stamey, Peter Holsapple, Paul Collins, Tom Petty. And despite all of the critical success, it's been less of a commercial thing for you. What do you feel about the state of the way music is now, with broken up into really little core audiences and cult audiences, as opposed to, you know, in the past, in the 60s, you'd basically try to appeal to everyone?
Well, I think it gets more and more splintered as time goes on, but I think it really depends on the generation of the listener. I mean, I have a nephew who's 17, and he listens to new bands, and then he goes back and he listens to Montrose or from the 70s, or Guided by Voices from the 90s, or the Replacement of the 80s, or the Minutemen. So I think actually it's a lot easier for nowadays for people to sort of go back and explore what came before them, because you have the internet and everything. Everything's right at your fingertips. Where right. I think in the old days it was more sort of talking to people at record stores and stuff, and word of mouth kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I have a very strange concept of who my audience is and who's really listening and who's out there waiting for the next record or coming to see the show. I mean, that's kind of a really broad question. I don't even know if I answered yours or not. Sorry.
Yeah, I guess that you did. That's fine. Yeah. I also think it's great that last year you came out with a big retrospective. A lot of people were looking forward to that because it's really hard to get a hold of your older albums. How did you come up with two things? How did you come up with the title, which I know a few critics have called corny? And how did you come up with, you know, the track listing? I mean, were you given free rein to pick anything you want?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the title, I don't know if you remember, if you're familiar with a guy named Jay Bennett that was in Wilco.
Yes.
Who passed away a couple years ago.
Yes.
He played my group from 93 to 98. And he came up with a couple of album titles, one of which was Isolation Party. And he came up with, which is basically when you're sitting in the studio and you solo a track, you isolate it from the rest of the 24 tracks or how many tracks you're recording. He said, oh, look, Tommy's having an isolation party. But Tommy, can you hear me? He said, you've got to come out with a record. Tommy Keen, you hear me? And I thought it was kind of, I mean, I've never done sort of a jokey, funny title. And everyone's always given me crap about being too serious, so I thought this was kind of funny. And if people thought it was too corny, then screw them. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, I thought I expected most people to just, you know, laugh about it or not care about it. You know,
yeah, so, I kind of laughed about it. Well, I kind of laughed about it myself, but I saw one reviewer was like, "I love everything about this album except the title." So
I got a bunch of those. Yeah.
And picking the tracks, did you, obviously you went for the popular hits from the early era, but what about later on when you were more on the radar of, you know, what I would call the power pop underground, who are really your rabid fans looking for stuff? Did you get any input from them, or you just basically said, I kind of like this song, I'm putting it on?
Yeah, no, I handpicked all the selections, and I knew that some people would miss this song or that song, but it's what I had to live with. So, believe me, if there was a song that was pretty popular that I didn't care for, it didn't make the cut, but I don't think there's really many cases of that. Just some deeper songs that everyone's always going to have a favorite, which is not going to come out on a best of collection. I mean, when I buy a best of whomever, there's one or two songs that I found really sort of touched me, and they're not even on the compilation. So, yes, I did pick everything.
All right, great. I know in the past you've worked with, you know, Velvet Crush, and you've also worked with Bob Pollard, Guided by Voices, and a few other notable people. Can you tell me, are you and Bob, would you ever get back together again, playing again, or?
Oh, sure, sure. He's pretty busy and kind of all over the place, though, and you know, this Guided by Voices reunion has really taken off, so I, you know, if he wanted to and the timing was right and someone came up with the financial aid to do it, yeah, sure, I'd love to. I was going to go out and tour with him this fall after my tour under Boston Spaceships, but I really don't think he's into that. Okay. I don't think he wants to go out and play for less people than he has been playing with Guided by Voices. And, you know, it's the brand name, and that's always going to draw the people.
Right.
Right? So,
okay.
I don't know. That's up in the air, but I'd be definitely into it.
All right, cool. Now, let's talk just a little bit about Behind the Parade, your new album. I love all the songs here. I think it's definitely one of your strongest albums. Can you tell me a little bit about the story behind one of the songs? Like, let's say, a really descriptive song like Nowhere Drag.
Nowhere Drag is completely fictitious.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've really been getting into sort of the last couple records. I've read a lot of books about Pulp Fiction and crime noir and hipster slang and jargon, and mostly this stuff originated with jazz and blues guys, specifically black musicians in the 30s, 20s, 30s, and 40s,
mm-hmm.
and just a lot of the colloquialisms they used to describe, you know, basically sex and rock and roll, and that kind of gave birth to the Beats and Kerouac and Ginsberg and the Bohemian movement and all that. And that kind of thing has always fascinated me. So a couple songs that I put out in the last couple of records have been these little vignettes of little stories of people sort of on the edge, you know, running for your life, sort of pushing the envelope, so to speak. And Nowhere Drag is a little story in there about people doing criminal things and getting caught and getting away with it and stuff.
Right. Do you have a favorite on the new album?
I think it's Nowhere Drag.
Okay. I'm glad
I know just the music, but I mean I think the lyrics are pretty groovy, but musically I'm just really happy with that one.
Cool.
Yeah. I wrote it in open tuning, and I think that has a lot to do with it.
Ah, well, it sort of seegs into my next question, which is, when you're putting together a song, what comes first, the lyrics or the melody?
Oh, always the melody, or a riff, or a little guitar motif. Sometimes I'll have an idea for a title, and I'll try to work that in, but no, it's usually it's always the lyrics. I mean, I'm sorry, the music.
The music.
I think for Bob Dylan and other people, they write poetry, and then they put that to music, but I don't really consider myself a poet. I just write pop rock lyrics.
Right. And you've also been performing for many years and stuff. After all these years, I don't know, how many years has it now been since your first recording?
That's Tommy Keene.
Yeah.
Came out in June 82.
Okay, so it's a long ways.
No, I've been playing in bands since I was 11.
Okay, that's what I meant. After all this time, how is it different making albums today, as opposed to, you know, earlier on in your career in your 20s?
Technically.
Well,
or
just the process, and I guess has it gotten easier as you've gotten older, or have you been just more critical of yourself or more meticulous in putting together music?
Well, I mean, you have to really go examine the technology of recording,
mm-hmm.
Which was back in the day, you kind of had to go to a studio and pay a lot of money, and usually you couldn't afford to go to a really good studio, and with major labels, they would sign you based on your little demos you did in the basement, and then they'd expect you to pair up with a quote-unquote hit producer. And that was always a lot of too many cooks in the kitchen. But nowadays, since about the last 10 years, I've had a little home studio. And I'm not a Pro Tools guy. but I do record digitally. But I have a board and a couple good mics and one good mic pre-compressor. So basically I can do anything but drums and mix. So that really was liberating to get to that point and not have to sit there and pay, you know, $70 an hour while I'm trying to perfect this guitar lead break. But I can do it any time, obviously. So I think that, you know, back in the days, it was just a lot more intimidating. And now you really can dial up the exact sounds you want and have them at your fingertips.
Great. So it sounds like it's a lot easier, actually.
Oh, yeah. I think for everyone. I mean, you can make an album on your laptop. I don't do that, but...
But you could. All right.
Good, yeah, a lot of people do.
Okay, another question. When performing, has it ever gotten to be an out-of-body experience for you at some point?
Well, there's been a couple times on stage I thought I was going to pass out or throw up. The funny thing is that you don't realize, and I didn't realize this until I started my own group, is that when you're up there and you're singing every song, there's a voice that starts... Now, I'm not crazy. There's a voice that starts talking to you in your head while you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're sort of singing and you're playing, so there's another part of your brain starts critiquing you along the way. Oh, you missed that note. Oh, look at that guy over there. He's bored. If you're just playing guitar, you don't really lock into that sort of trance. It's a very, very weird thing. I wonder if other people, singers, feel this way.
Well, I've heard a few other players. I've interviewed a few other people who actually mentioned that. I think, you know, a member of Paul McCartney's band used to always look at Paul, and Paul would look back when he made a mistake, and they just nod. And it was like, okay,
oh,
keep
really?
Going.
Was it
yeah.
Rusty Anderson?
I think it was
the blonde guy.
Yeah, yeah,
Brian Ray.
Well, and, that's good that Paul's forgiving. I've played with some people who aren't.
Anyway, gets me to the next question. If you could travel back in time to any music era, where would you travel to and why?
I would go back to the Fillmore East from the years, say, 68 to, when did it close, 71, 72?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big mystique about that place, and I guess it was amazing, and it had a great vibe and great acoustics. And if you look at all the bands that played there in that three-year period, it's just anyone you'd ever want to see. And the bills were so interesting. Like, they'd put blues guys on with The Who, or you know, Taj Mahal with Cream, or something, and fascinating. And I would like to go there and sort of go there every night for a couple of years.
That's a good answer. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So where's your tour starting? Is it how long is it going?
Well, we started the other night in Los Angeles,
okay.
Tuesday, and then I flew to D.C. last night, and we play D.C. tomorrow night, and then we do Brooklyn, Boston, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Minneapolis.
Great.
So it's basically hitting the places where I know I can get a decent crowd and everyone can have a good time.
Great. Well, just to sort of wrap things up, did you have any, I would say, like your most embarrassing moment or your most, you know, your wildest moment on stage?
I can think of an embarrassing moment.
Okay.
I was playing with Paul Westerberg, and there's a replacement song called Swinging Party, and I could never come up with anything that he liked. And he would say to me, play it like drunk jazz. And that was a little obtuse for me to follow. Plus, I could have done that, but I didn't think that would sound very good. And he stopped the show in the middle of that song and yelled at me, berated me in front of the audience that I sucked. And then he said, what do you expect from a guy who likes Cheap Trick?
Oh, a power pop diss.
Yeah, but he likes Cheap Trick, so he was really just having you laugh at me.
Well, I mean, I know in the past you haven't exactly embraced the power pop label, but I really think that, like I had mentioned earlier when I first got on the call with you, that you're one of the people that, you know, basically embodies that sound. You know, I know you've come to terms with it at this point. You know, I know a huge advocate was Paul Collins when I was speaking to him. It's like he trumpets that all the time. I know you're a little you're a little more laid back in that respect, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a ghetto that, I mean, for better or for worse, I'm sort of, people stick me in. And my whole point is, a lot of that music to me is people emulating people.
Yeah.
Emulating a certain sound, a certain look, whether it's, we want to make a record that sounds like Pet Sounds, mm-hmm. or I'm going to dress up in a striped shirt with a Rickenbacker and a Bo Brummel haircut because I think that's cool. And that is kind of cool, but it's just not, I'm just trying to be myself. And I think the power pop term is used in, to its, in a good way, a lot of times, but because everybody's power pop, from the Ramones to Elvis Costello to The Who.
That's true.
To Blink 182.
Yeah, everyone has their moments.
When they talk about that, it's this very narrowly defined ghetto subgenre that has never gotten any respect because people think it's too lightweight and fluffy and doesn't really have a lot of substance or meaning or even lasting power and, you know, through time. And so that is a little, sometimes not so fun to be a part of that.
Well, it's kind of, I think it's kind of iron.
I don't like a lot of those power pop bands that people lump me into. I don't like The Knack. I like that band 2020 from L.A.
Right.
I like Cheap Trick. I like the Plimsolls. A lot of those bands that sing about, you know, girls and cars, I find really kind of boring. I mean, I'd rather probably listen to some guy, you know, playing an out-of-tune dobro. To me, that's more interesting than trying to emulate the Beatles.
Right.
Although I'm certainly guilty of that. So.
All right. Well, on that.
But, hey, you know, anyone that buys my records or listens to the songs or comes see me live, I love them.
That's great. I appreciate your time, Tommy. Once again,
where are you calling from?
Actually, I'm calling from New York. Thank you very much for your time. And Tommy Keane, Behind the Parade, it's on sale now on your website and on Amazon and every place else. And thanks so much for the interview.
All right. My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
All right. Take it easy.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.